to Women Worth Knowing, the radio program and podcast hosted by Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones-Gunn.
Hello there, beautiful listeners. We are excited to tell you today about Eileen Coleman. I know very little about her, so I'm glad Cheryl's going to bring us up to date. But I do know one thing. She was the youngest of seven children, and all her older siblings were brothers.
I know. Is that crazy?
Yes. She was born in South Queensland, Australia in 1930. And Cheryl, you just find the most interesting women to tell us about. I love it.
Well, she's still living today. She's 95 years old, 94, 95. And this is a book that's been sitting on a shelf for a really, really long time. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to read. Now that I'm semi-retired, I'm trying to do more reading and more writing and just do what I'm supposed to do. But as you said, yes, she was born in 1930. She said that her brothers made her tough. And that was...
I would imagine.
I do too. I had two and it made me pretty tough. But the resiliency, she said, came because of having these older brothers. So, you know, Australia is a hard place to grow up, especially Queensland area. I mean, they've got more poisonous animals and bugs than anywhere.
Let's not get into the snakes.
Yeah, that's right.
Why did there have to be snakes?
But this is what they did. In order to teach her to swim, they put a rope around her waist and threw her overboard on a boat and pulled her until she could swim.
Oh, dear.
She ended up going into swimming competitions and winning all of them. So I guess it worked,
not
you know?
Not necessarily a recommended process, but right. There you go.
So her father was a certified public accountant, and her mother was a homemaker and felt like she needed to stay home just to keep the boys corralled and probably to protect...
I would imagine so.
Eileen a lot. She, by her own admission, was a rebellious child. And I could see that with so many brothers trying to oppress and, you know, boss her around. She had to grow up holding her own.
Yeah.
So her parents were deeply grieved, though, by her rowdy behavior. Can you imagine having six boys and suddenly, I'm sorry, she had six brothers. She was the youngest of seven. Having six brothers and your parents finally get their girl, and your mom is probably hoping to dress you in pink and ruffles and have a best friend. And instead, she gets this little toughy, right?
Yes.
So tough that by the time she was in high school and college, she was known as the happy drunk. She was constantly drunk. She was a partier. She was a rebel rouser. She never said no to any dare. And in fact, a dare would spur her on to do some very dangerous things. So one day while she's in college, somebody tells her that there's a circus in town, but it doesn't have any animals. And she's curious about the circus without animals. And somebody dares her to go. And she's like, is this religious? And they're like, I double dare you. Well, again, this is Eileen, and she never said no to a dare. So she went and she heard the gospel. And her heart was melted that first night, and she went forward at the invitation. And it was one of those things where she knew immediately that her whole life was going to have to change and that she no longer was in charge of Eileen. And so she started just submitting everything to the Lord.
Yes.
And she felt that she was to change her major to nursing. And when she told that to her father, even though they were so excited that she was a Christian, he was so grieved. He wanted her to follow some other career path. I'm not quite sure. She never mentions what that other career was, but she chose nursing. She graduated with nursing degree, and then she felt led to do a postgraduate degree in obstetrics. So she got a postgraduate degree in obstetrics. But after she finished that, she felt like she needed Bible college. She felt like her knowledge of the Bible was so slim and she needed more. Mm-hmm. So she signed up for a two-year program for Bible college. A couple interesting things happened while she was doing this two-year program. One is she fell in love with a young doctor. In fact, he fell in love with her. They were madly in love. Others said of Eileen that she was tall and absolutely beautiful, a perfect figure and just gorgeous. Some even said she could have become a model had she chosen to do so. She was
from the childhood description. You think, oh, she's going to have scars on her face.
Right.
She's going to be rowdy. And
Wow. Bruised, right? Battered, yeah, broken yeah. limbs. Nope. She was beautiful. And so she fell in love with this doctor, and they were so deeply, deeply in love. But he felt like he had a call to Africa. And during her time at college, one of her classes required that they do a report on a missionary living in a different country. And her lot fell to finding a missionary in a Muslim country. So she found an obstetrician, which, you know, because that was her degree. Mm-hmm. She had her postgraduate work in obstetrics. And so she found a Dr. Sarah Hossman, who was an obstetrician living in Saudi. So she wrote to her. And this correspondence started as Aileen was interviewing her, you know, what's it like to be a missionary? What are your greatest struggles? And so that's who she decided to do her report on.
But let's just think about correspondence from Australia
yes.
to Saudi in
yes.
the 40s, 50s. Like, this
right.
is weeks and weeks
right.
waiting to get the reply.
Right. And, you know, it's an assignment for school. So during the course of their correspondence, Dr. Sarah Hossman asked Aileen to pray for her and said, you know, our greatest need right now is a nurse who has postgraduate experience with obstetrics. Our whole staff is praying that the Lord would send us a nurse
very specific
with a postgraduate mm-hmm. degree in obstetrics. And so this is what I find so interesting. Aileen starts praying for that woman or that man that the Lord would
surely
raise that person up.
Someone.
Right, because she's engaged now. She's very
yes.
serious about yes. this young doctor. Africa is on his map. But the more she prays, the more she knows it's her.
Wow.
And so with a broken heart, she tells him, I know I'm called to a Muslim country, and I know that's where my skill set is needed. And he knew he was called to Africa, and so they broke their engagement, both of them just crying. She said it was probably the most heartbreaking moment of her life. And she'll go through so many situations that are very dangerous, but this she marked as the most heartbreaking. But they both loved God foremost, and they felt that they had each pledged their lives to the Lord and could not take possession back from the Lord of their lives. So he went off to Africa, and in 1955, she went to Saudi and began to work with Dr. Hossman. Now, she's only 25 years old, and she joins the Sharjah Hospital near Bahrain. And she said her schedule is that she delivers babies from sunup to sundown and all during the night.
Oh.
Just hundreds of babies. Her schedule is so crazy, right?
Oh.
And then Dr. Hossman takes sick, and she can't get out of bed. And this young girl comes in, and she's been laboring for days, and she needs an emergency C-section. And she's like, I've never done a C-section, and my skill set, you know, doesn't cover that. But Dr. Hossman said, look, there's no other choice. You have got to do this C-section. You can do it. So she got the manual out, and having the manual set before her, she operated on this young girl who was just in her teens and did the C-section following page by page.
Can you imagine?
And the baby was healthy. The mother was healthy. It was a success on all fronts. One of the things she said that was so difficult in treating these young Bedouin women was they would try to labor at home for the most part. So by the time that they got to the hospital, it was a dangerous scenario. Very, very dangerous. And secondly, they were young. Most of the moms were between like 13 and 20 years old.
Oh.
Really young. So these girls were taken as child brides from the age of 12 on. So another difficulty was that after the girls were gave birth, one of the Bedouin customs was to take the vaginal cavity and fill it with rock salt. because of the to stop the bleeding. And what it did is it created scar tissue.
Sure.
So that when the second child was about to be born, it couldn't come through the vaginal canal because of all the scar tissue. So she was always dealing with situations like that, that were pretty tremendous. And she was frustrated because she was not able to clearly give them instructions in Arabic. Her Arabic was so broken, and just what she was learning around the hospital, and they didn't understand. So she decided that she really needed to get another degree in Arabic. So she found out that the London University in Jerusalem had a course on Arabic. And in Bethlehem, there was a hospital called Baraka Hospital, which was actually a sanatorium for tuberculosis. But she could work there and attend college, because I think Bethlehem and Jerusalem are less than 20 miles apart. So she figured she could do the commute. At the time, Bethlehem was under Jordanian control. So she went from Saudi to Jordan, because this is 1956 or 57. So she goes to Baraka Hospital, and Baraka means blessing. So she goes to this hospital. It's a Christian hospital. It's between really Bethlehem and Hebron. And she meets a Dr. Eleanor Saltau. And Dr. Eleanor Saltau and she will become best friends, and just so close and so tight. Now, the interesting thing about Eleanor is she was the grandchild of missionary parents and the daughter of missionary parents. And her parents had served in Korea. And she had actually, Dr. Eleanor Saltau, had gone to school, Christian missionary school in Korea, with Ruth Bell Graham.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They were friends. And so they had known each other in school in Korea. During World War II, they were both, had to leave Ruth, China, and Eleanor's parents had to leave Korea. And her father became a pastor of a church in Tennessee, where he continued to pastor for years and years and years. And during that time, Eleanor contracted tuberculosis. And her case was so severe that she ended up losing a lung, but was still able to function without an oxygen machine. She lived just with one lung. Interestingly enough, that she would decide... when she went to college, she went to Wheaton College, and that's where she and Ruth met up again, and we're still friends. But when Ruth married Dr. Eleanor Saltau, she went to medical school and became a specialist in thoracic, the study of the chest, and especially specializing in tuberculosis. So she's at this sanatorium working with these TB patients when she meets Aileen, and they would talk a lot about how they would like to start their own hospital in Jordan. And they would even look at maps and say, this is where we want to start it, in Mafraq. Why they chose Mafraq, nobody knows, but that was the destination that, as they talked, they chose. Well, Eleanor graduated with her degree, another degree in Arabic, and her Arabic, she was so proficient in Arabic that people and Arabs who met her thought it was her first language.
Really? That's unusual.
It really was.
Goodness.
She's a smarty.
Oh my God.
She's a smarty.
I just keep wondering, on all these milestones, who challenged her and said, I bet you can't do it.
Exactly. Who dared her?
Yeah,
right?
Really? Watch.
I double dare you. Right. Yeah. So she became, just absolutely proficient. In fact, the writer of A Desert Rat talked about being with her when these young men started taunting them, thinking that they were two American women, these young Jordanian boys. And Aileen turned to them and started just speaking Arabic to them. And the boys' eyes widened and they stepped back and they were shaking their heads, yes. And she was very strong in whatever she was saying. So the author, Annette, asked her, "What were you saying?" She said, "I was saying to them, it's time to be proud of your heritage. Do you know how many came before you? You are bringing dishonor to your culture and to your fathers and to your father's fathers because you've got the honor-shame culture there."
Yes.
And the boys really received it. And boy, they never bothered Aileen again. So anyway, as they're talking about it, this plan began to form. And one day, a man named Roy Gustafson visited. Now, he's kind of well-known in a lot of circles. He used to lead tours to Israel and to Jordan in those days. And do you know him?
No.
Okay, he worked with Brother Andrew, too, so that's why I was like...
That was a foreign click in my mind. Like, I think I've heard some of these overlapping stories, but not his name didn't ring a bell.
Right.
So, amazing.
Mm-hmm. So he... They speak to him. They said, "Look, we don't have any money, but we're feeling this really strongly." So he said, "Well, let me pray for you." And so then he sent them Ecclesiastes 11:4-6, this message: "Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle. For you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, whether both will do equally well." And then he said, "Just get up and do it." Now, I forgot to mention that Dr. Soltau had gone back to the United States and gone to, you know, her father's church and other places trying to raise support, and it didn't seem like anybody was interested.
Mm.
She wasn't able to raise any money. In the meantime, Aileen's writing friends and family in Australia and all over, and nobody's contributing. And that was one of the reasons that they talked to, you know, Roy, is like, "What do we do?"
Yeah.
And he said, you just do it. And so they drove over. They had a Volvo. They drove to Mafraq. And they found a house, 2,100 square foot house, and they figured, well, we could take this house and we could fix it up and we could make this house work. Well, the owner who was selling it wanted $1,000, and they had $50 between them.
Mm.
They did not have $1,000. So they began to pray. And they,
you know, sometimes we say, "Oh, yes, well, we know the walk of faith." No, yes. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. We do not know. This is so true. So then they said, "Okay, well, this is 1965. We'll purchase it. We will do this." And he said, "All right." And so they started praying, and they were hoping for, you know, maybe funds in America. The Lord would put it on somebody's heart. Interestingly enough, Dr. Eleanor got a note from the United States of an investment that she had made, or her parents had made for her, somebody, as a young student. And there was $1,100 check coming to her from that investment.
Of course there was. Love stories like this.
Exactly. So they used that $1,000. They purchased the property. And with the $100, they set to work, you know, makeshift hospital beds and bringing equipment in.
Mm.
And they opened a hospital that could take 16 patients. That's it. Just 16 patients. And for the next 8 years, they made this work. But they had to do with things like not only the Bedouin ailments, but also with the superstitions and dangerous Bedouin practices. Like if you had a broken arm, they would burn the limb, thinking that it would take away the evil spirit that was causing you pain. And then another times they would use hot spikes to drive the demons out. So these obviously caused greater injuries. When they opened their hospital, they named it Anor, A-N-N-O-O-R, which means light. And they proclaimed that this was going to be a Christian hospital. Now, let's think about this again.
Yeah.
These are two young women, one of them very beautiful, who have gone to Jordan, women, right?
Yep.
And decided to open a hospital. So they're in a very chauvinistic country that thinks that women should be just wives and mothers and never speak and never have any rights. And they're buying property and they're opening up a hospital that they proclaim will be a Christian hospital in a Muslim land. And they say, at this hospital, we will not allow any worship of Allah. Can you imagine? They said this hospital will constantly glorify the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Wow. They played hymns. They had music playing constantly, and it was hymns. And they would teach the nurses that they trained hymns. And they would start out every morning singing hymns with a Bible study. And they would read the Bible to all the patients. They would pray before every surgery. They would pray with every patient about how to get the right diagnosis and the right treatment. And their hospital was flooded constantly. And as a side note, many of their patients came on camels. In fact, most of their patients came to the hospital via camels, a few mules, and every once in a while by a car.
Wow.
Is that just in?
Just no boundaries with
no
the
boundaries.
Lord.
No boundaries the
Lord
with the Lord.
Opens all the doors and he blessed them. He blessed them. Wow.
What is really, really interesting is just 2 years after opening this first hospital in Mafraq, the Six-Day War broke out in 1967. So, you know, right away. And these were very, very dangerous times. But the women refused to leave their post. They were like, nope, we're here. We signed up for the duration. We're not leaving. And they stayed through the Six-Day War. And then in and their vehicles were even stolen. Wow. In 1970, there was the Civil War where the PLO took over the country, overran the country for a short time. And again, their vehicles were stolen. Now, Aileen was concerned about how they would get food for all their patients and staff. And outside guarding the grounds were all these PLO with their machine guns and their, you know, what are they called? Their
headdress.
Their headdress, their scarves. And so she went up to one of the terrorists and she said, I want you to return our cars because we can't get food and our patients are going to starve. And these are your own people that supposedly you care about and you're going to protect. And he said, I can't return your cars, but I will do something. So he ended up going to the market for her and coming back with just boxes and boxes of groceries. But she inspected him and said, no, this is not good enough. I want you to take this back to the vendor. I know his name. And she sent him back. And so here's this hardened PLO terrorist with a machine gun who is doing her shopping and taking his instructions from Aileen, a woman.
That's incredible. Aaron Boy.
Aaron Boy, exactly.
Back, get the right stuff this time. That's don't come home without what I asked
do
for.
Do not come home
what
without
a
it.
Fortitude she had.
Yeah.
And just, to be in this sweet partnership with someone who understands the deep love for the people, the desire to just give everything to the Lord in ministry. I just love seeing how God provided all her needs, including a sweet, close friend. Just lovely.
You know, besides reading the book, A Desert Rap, which was, you know, great, I listened to a podcast that you can listen to, and I've got it in the notes.
Oh, good.
But where she's talking, she's 88 at the time, and she's being interviewed by Samaritan's Purse. And the interview is so incredible because, you know, somebody said, how did you stay? How did you get that fortitude? Yeah. And she said, you know, when you're certain of the call of God on your life, you're certain of everything else.
Okay.
You're certain of his protection. You're certain of his timing.
Repeat that again, Cheryl. Our listeners need to hold on to that one.
When you're sure of the call of God on your life, you are sure of everything else.
Amen.
It brings this certain confidence that,
so good.
You know, she was sure that she was called to minister to those Bedouin people alongside Dr. Eleanor Saltoa. And so they would not leave, you know, terrorist, civil war, whatever, the Six-Day War, they were not going to leave their post. The Lord would protect them. And he did. So that's only part one, because
there will be so much more.
Yes.
I can't wait.
Yes, so much more to Eileen Coleman's life that you're going to want to hear and not going to want to miss.
Thank you for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. For more information on Cheryl, visit CherylBroderson.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. For more information on Robin, visit RobinGunn.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. Join us each week for a lively conversation as we explore the lives of well-known and not-so-well-known historical and contemporary Christian women. If you think there is a woman worth knowing, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at WWK@CCCM.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you rate us on your podcast app, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you again for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. Women Worth Knowing is a production of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.